I wish it were. It was just
that'd
a smaller state. We can
call a House Committee on Health Care together and open this session on a Friday afternoon. A couple of things. First, you will all have, we asked Dr. Goldberg to share with us the report on transforming, on the transformation roadmap for DHS. I think you'll find it very interesting.
Good routine.
If you haven't had any experience in your other life with McKinsey, you'll find it even more interesting, I think. I guess I do want to say that we're going to start getting serious on the question of the hospital tax, and specifically, somebody's got a BlackBerry beeping.
And buzzing.
Could we get them all shut off, please? That would be very helpful. And I think within the next couple of weeks, after we come back from Grants Pass, we're going to start getting very specific about what a hospital tax is like, how to collect it, and maybe put some numbers in for the hypothesis. We have to get that train moving out of the station one of these days, so we're going to get started relatively shortly. I'm going to open a work session on 2194, which is a an almost pro forma bill for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, and it does actually only one thing, which isn't necessarily defining medical insurance. That is a pro forma thing that simply conforms to other stuff. But the most important thing it does is it it changes. Why am I doing this? That's what you get paid all these big bucks for.
Because you didn't say Madam Administrator.
Madam Administrator, you tell us what we're up to here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HB 2194 comes to you from the Department of Consumer and Business Services on behalf of the Oregon Medical Assistance Insurance Pool. We had a public hearing on this bill February 2nd. It modifies and conforms the definition of medical insurance with the DCBS current definition. It does some other things. What we, at that time, OMIP testified for some technical amendments. What you have before you are the Dash 1 amendments. What the Dash 1 amendments are doing is adding the S-CHIP, which is a state children's health insurance program, into the list of programs that are not included in the assessment of programs. It is a technical bill. It also eliminated, for whatever reason, in past, it was identified as automobile medical insurance. We took out medical health insurance, and so now it just says automobile and automobile insurance. We also have a no fiscal impact statement before us on the Dash 1s, as now is required by our committee rules, before the committee can take action on anything, and I believe that's it, Mr. Chair.
And on the bill itself as well?
Well, it's on the Dash, yes, and we...
It's on the bill with the Dash 1.
Correct. Okay. Thank you. And Representative Kettemer had his hand up.
Yeah, did I open that work session?
Yes.
Okay.
Just on line 13 on the Dash 1 amendments, it should be a small L if it matters.
That's a form and style, and I think it's so it doesn't get confused.
With an I.
Oh, or the one.
That is an intentional thing coming out of legislative council.
I'll be darned.
Yes.
Okay. I'll be darned.
That's why there's no J Street in Washington or something. High Street. Okay. I'm ready to receive a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
Take it power.
Dated.
Power grab.
Restarting. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated February 10 of 2009.
Representative Harker moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated February 10th. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, we'll move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2194. Representative Harker?
Mr. Chair, I move HB 2194 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion? Seeing none, will you please call the roll?
Yes. Representative Bryan?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Excused.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Excused.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Aye. Could I hear in a motion to put this on the consent agenda, which is typically for things for which there's no real opposition or problem or complexity?
I'll make that motion.
Okay. That we put it on that we put House Bill 2194 on the consent agenda. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. We'll move it to the consent agenda. I'll close the work session on 2194 and open an informational meeting. Do we have any? We don't have any committee bills.
Not at this time, Mr. Chair. Unless somebody else.
There are a set of bills that the governor proposed. Being worked in the Senate right now around things that could ultimately go into House Bill 2009 or, in fact, could be ultimately handled as independent bills. And as we all know, in addition to dealing with increasing the Medicaid population, the Oregon Health Plan population in the state, the Health Fund Board also had several other objectives intended to make the whole process sustainable. Included in those objectives were to bend the cost curve to reduce costs for the healthcare system, increase access for people even when they have health insurance, deal with assuring that there's enough human resources to serve the people who of the state whether or not they have health insurance, and improving the quality of the healthcare system, including such issues as proposing a quality institute to be added to the Oregon Health Authority to help do this. There are various ongoing quality activities in the state, and I thought it would be useful if we had a chance to get some informational testimony to help us get a handle on what's happening now. So I've asked for three different efforts that are going on complementarily, because we only have, this is a state with not 6 degrees of separation, but maybe 3 degrees of separation at most. So all of the same folks keep showing up in the same committee, and I know, and I end up being there sometimes as Representative Maurer, and we can't figure out which committee it is. I think it would be very useful if we could hear about all three of them and have a chance to query what's going on. So the first thing I'll call you one at a time. That's probably the easiest way. I'll call Nancy Clark, who I know is extremely competent because in a former life for both of us, she actually worked for me.
I did.
Well, let's see. That's true of at least a couple of the people we may hear from today. And Nancy, will you introduce yourself and tell us what you're talking about?
Yes, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Chairman Greenlick and members of the
committee.
You
might want to pull that mic closer to you.
This one, Mike.
Does that work?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Clark. I am executive director of an organization called the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation, and I'm delighted to be here today, and I appreciate very much the invitation. I would like to tell you just very briefly who we are. We're a nonprofit organization. We are what we call multi-stakeholders. So what we do is bring together around one table the people who buy healthcare, both for employers, also from the public side, with providers, doctors, clinicians, nurses, with insurers, with consumers, with policymakers, and we all get around the table and we say, what can we actually get done to measure and improve the quality of healthcare? So that's what we do.
I'd like to just very briefly make a couple of quick points and then spend my time, just as you've asked, describing what we're doing around quality and quality measurement with, from a multi-stakeholder position. So the first thing I would say, of course, is that improving the quality of healthcare is a critical part of the path to better value for the state's healthcare dollars. And I know all of the work that you have from the Health Fund Board and all of the work that's embedded in 2001 makes that point that quality is going to save us money at definitely in the long run, and a lot of it also in the short run, that doing things well, doing them according to evidence-based practice is the more cost-effective approach, and quality is embedded throughout the health plan and the proposals that you have. A specific point related to the Health Fund Board is that a virtual quality institute is mentioned, and I want to just emphasize that a public-private partnership approach to this could be very efficient and a very good investment on work that's already underway. So with that very quick introduction, let me talk a little bit about what we are doing at the Quality Corp. So if you look at this slide, up there at the top, we have a lot of insurers in Oregon. So I used, you know, the nice office building to represent health insurers in Oregon. And then we have a lot of clinics, right? We've got physicians and nurses that are in clinics delivering care. And you know, a health insurer says, we need to do evidence-based practice. So you doctors, I'm going to help you with some evidence-based practice. What I'm going to do is take my data, and I'm going to sort it and organize it for you and send it to you, and I'm going to tell you whether you're getting an A, B, or a C, or an F, you know, on this. And I'm going to give you some information about, you know, the patients that are in our plan so you can do a better job. Well, if it's a good idea for one plan, you know, it's probably a good idea for another plan, and then for another plan, and pretty soon, this is what it looks like to a clinician. You know, you've got a big stack of reports on your desk. They came at different times. They're using different measures. They're telling you, you know, one says you got an A on these four patients, another says you got an F on these, you know, six patients, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And unfortunately, what's happening is most of these reports, I think, are just going into the trash can because they're not very useful. So we have a better way to do that, and this is called the Partner for Quality Care, Information for a Healthy Oregon. This is an initiative that we've been working on for a little while. And what this does is say, you know, why don't we do this in a more coordinated way? Let's all agree on what the common measures are there. So we're all measuring the same thing the same way, using the same data, the same terms, and the same evidence base to decide what's really important. Let's put that information together, and let's organize it and then send it back out to the clinics, you know, as one single solid report, and that would be a much better way to do it. There's one other new wrinkle in the way we do it when we can do this jointly as a multi-stakeholder group, and that is the transparency. Transparency word that you hear so much about, which is let's all be able to look at this data now. It's not in a dozen different little reports that don't have any, you know, statistical significance, and it's now in one report where we can say, what's the quality of care? How is our delivery system doing? How can we make things better? So this is what we've been working on, and I would like to say that this is extremely hard work. It's very, very difficult to do. I was here about 2 years ago, and we had just succeeded in getting an agreement to work together. We had all agreed on the common evidence-based measure set that we were going to use, and I was, you know, quite thrilled that we were just going to be charging off. Of course, it came time to finance that system, and we looked around, and everybody had left the room all of a sudden. and so it took a little while to get the enthusiasm, to get folks to say, yes, this is worth doing together. And a very important point was when several of the health plans said, you know, we could actually stop doing what we're doing one at a time, put that same amount of money together with others and do this jointly, and it would be better serve the patients of Oregon, it would better serve our health care value and our health care dollars. So we got past the financing hurdle, and then we got on to the legal framework and data use agreements and privacy and security protections, which is a hugely, hugely complicated activity. So once we got the CEOs, we had to get the lawyers in the room to help us agree on how we could do this and how we could do it well, making sure that we were at the top of our game in terms of protecting privacy and security and being legal about it. So then the next challenge, well,
Ms. Clark, can you go back to that first slide? I want to make sure Representative Maurer is always explaining to us how this happens.
That one?
Yeah.
Is that what it feels like?
Quality each of the health insurers having their own idea of dealing with each of the clinics on how they ought to, measure quality.
I would not only agree with that, but the information that we actually see in the clinic is, for the most part, absolutely and totally worthless.
And yes. Now we're trying to improve it, right? You can now move.
And we have a better plan.
I was impressed with that slide because it does depict what everybody is telling us.
Right.
And that's with only, and Chairman Greenlee and members of the committee, that's with only, you know, 5 in the picture. We're working with 11, and we still don't have them all, you know. So it is pretty complicated. I just got tired of drawing arrows. another point, you know, that row along the bottom of the clinics, you know, so we said now it's time to go, you know, figure out what the clinics are. Let's get the list. There is no list. There's no list of clinics in Oregon. Nobody, you know, what's a list? It turned out every one of the plans had a different idea. Some of them used call groups. Some of them used contracting pods. Some of them used, you know, tax numbers, whatever. And so, you know, we try never to have a meeting when we don't have all the stakeholders in the room, I mean, represented there. And fortunately, at that meeting, we had a consumer at the table. And the consumer said, well, I know what a clinic is. You know, I drive in the parking lot, there's a sign on the door, you know, and that's a clinic. And we said, you're right. Okay, so we defined a clinic as a door with a sign on it, and now we've been doing a lot of very, very hard work calling the clinics to say who practices here and have we got the right list.
Mr. Chair, so would someone that doesn't have a door be a clinic? Because there are providers out there with no doors.
They will be very, very hard for us to find.
But they do file claims. So, I mean, they're getting paid. Referring to, I mean, literally, there are providers that have no door.
Chairman Greenlee and Representative Maurer, we're taking the bites that we can take first, and finding those kinds of providers are going to be some of the harder ones. We made a decision, and I'll tell you another, you know, multi-stakeholder story, is we said, well, which clinics will we work with? You know, are we going to work with the vans that move and the people that move among clinics? Or we had, you know, one group that said, well, how about if we start with clinics or 20 or more? Well, we had another employer in the room, and she said, sorry, but, you know, I've got employees all over the state. How about if we start with clinics of one or more? And so we wrangled and wrangled, and we settled on 4. So we'll be starting with clinics that have 4 or more primary care providers in them as a place where we can bite off about 75% of the population's care to be in our measurement pool. But we've got a long way to go to get to all of those situations, such as the ones that you're bringing up, which is a very important issue for rural Oregon. So,
yes.
Sorry.
Would you all just please go ahead and ask a question if you have it?
Hey, I have
Nancy,
one.
Nancy, if you and the people follow you, just go ahead and answer the question, and let's see if we can get by with breaking protocol.
Freewheeling discussion.
If our clerk doesn't notice that we're doing it. She's usually keeping an eye on me, but please just ask the question
when
you have it.
This is just follow-up on
and
the...
Please just answering them.
Follow-up on the doorless providers. You're talking web-based approach here, right?
Chairman,
they all have IP addresses is where I'm going?
Chairman Greenlee and Representative Parker, no, they don't.
Oh, they don't.
Many of them don't. Part of our process is web-based, and part of it is not. So if I could back up, I think I can back up. So the part that's in the top half of the screen is definitely web-based. The health plans use secure portals and encryption to submit data to the Partner for Quality Care central group that is managing the data for everyone. We use paper to send out the aggregate results from the center to the clinics. That will be a paper process, and that only has aggregate information, and that's because we don't know how to get everyone on an electronic form. But you'll notice those are two-way arrows. And so for clinics that want to, that choose to, they can sign up with us for a password and a secure portal, and then they may download patient-specific information and more detail about their quality scores using an encryption process and get the detail that they need.
So it can be paper if they want?
Yes, it can be. Mm-hmm.
Some examples of doorless providers?
I think we...
Senator Maurer?
Yeah. No, Kinnamer wants an example of a doorless provider.
What are you talking about?
A doorless provider would be a primary care physician who works independently and carries around a BlackBerry and has relationships with individuals, has a provider number, I mean, has contracts with, you know, insurance companies, but yet physically they go, the provider goes to them. There are very few of them, but the point is, I mean, there have actually been more over the last 5 years. But, I mean, they clearly are not the, they're the rare exception, not the...
Okay.
That might be a good time to point out that what's happening in these boxes down here that I'm calling clinics, the information is available at the individual provider level, but we are aggregating it and making it available, and it will be available to the public at the clinic level. We think that that's very consistent with the concept of a medical home, the concept of team care, and we believe that the extra work that it takes to roll up providers and turn them into a clinic, that's the unit that we try to measure and try to understand and try to support with quality data, is important. And it does take a lot of work to do that. Shall I keep whining about how hard it is?
can we think of it? We'll stipulate that.
We have almost succeeded in the clinic directory. We know we won't get it quite right the first time, but data will be going to those clinics at the end of this month for the first time, and that's how we know we will get some more attention to fix that data and correct it and make it even better. We also, and this goes exactly to what Representative Maurer is talking about, is it's critical that we make this information something that is actually useful to clinicians, or why bother? And so we have been having lots of 7 a.m. meetings. We've been having listening sessions, talking to clinicians about what is it. We know this is claims data, which is not, you know, the best. We also know that it's a little old, but what is it that's of value to you that then we can, you know, work with and work on the issues then around timeliness and build on our infrastructure to get more and more information. So, for example, what we are hearing from a physician is that I have patients with asthma, and I know what I prescribe for those patients with asthma. I prescribe two medicines for them. One of them is short-acting, and one of them is long-acting, but I don't know what they're filling. You know, I don't know if they're filling their prescriptions or not. And so the physicians have said to us, we really appreciate getting that ratio. You give me a ratio, and that tells me that, gosh, I think they're taking a lot of that one that, you know, works really fast and makes them feel better but isn't really making them healthier over the long run, and that's useful to clinicians.
May I ask you a question about that? With the Medicare requirement for e-prescribing, or just the e-prescribing wave that is going to hit us soon or is hitting us now, is that going to help in that data collection in that regard?
Representative Greenlick and Representative Maurer, I think it definitely will. We're not quite there yet. I think the importance of what we're doing is starting to build, you know, the links. You know, what's a clinic? What's the electronic address? What's the electronic exchange? How do you start to have that in there? Then as we move toward more electronic records, we can have lab data. We can have more e-prescribing data. We can work on how do we turn that into something that might more closely approximate a patient record at some point. But we have to, you know, we're working in one piece of that will take a while before we get to the e-prescribing approach.
This almost seems like you're doing the interoperability. You're hitting the interoperability hurdle that is really the key piece of electronic health records. I mean, am I comment?
Representative Greenlick and members of the committee, I don't want to get too ambitious. I hope we are. I hope we are building some building blocks that will help move us toward that piece. We are not, however, creating a patient record. You know, at this time, we are not creating a permanent patient record that we stay and retain information, et cetera. We are simply taking what the plans already do and putting it in the same envelope and sending it back out. So, you know, on the one hand, what we're doing is useful to move us toward there. We start to have the infrastructure, the password approach, the what's a clinic, who's accountable, how do we deal with proxy
proxies, what are the legal arrangements, but we're not prepared to actually create records yet, to make sure that we have a patient portal on that to manage that information. That's very, very ambitious, and I think the good news is we can be working on those simultaneously. We can be working on the different pieces, and because, as you said, there's only 3 degrees of separation in Oregon, we know what each other are doing, and we can be making those things so that they will mesh at the right time.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how all three of the things we're going to talk about today really mesh.
So, working with physicians to make this useful, lots and lots of technical details about sample size, you know, what are the benchmarks, are we benchmarking against each other, are we benchmarking against nationally, what's achievable, the formats for the reports, and then just series after series of validation and testing. We want to get this right, and it takes quite a bit of time to get the wrinkles out and to make this work. And I particularly want to highlight the consumer reporting formats and web design piece of that, because we've got to make the consumers our partners in understanding what quality is, why they should care, and what they can do about it. Right now, most consumers they just assume that all care is the same. They don't have any concept that care varies. And in the Health Fund report, it talks all about evidence-based practice. Well, a consumer doesn't know what that is. So we're trying to figure out how do we.
Nor
talk
do most
about
physicians.
How do we talk about what is care that works? You know, we've been doing a lot of consumer testing. Care that works is something that resonates. What's the right amount of care? We haven't gone to print on this one yet. We're still arguing over. We're trying to get across that message. The right amount of care is not too much care and not too little care. That's a very, very complicated piece, but it's absolutely central to what we're trying to do with a better value for our healthcare dollar. We're trying to make the patient our partner in understanding that. So we have been working with groups like AARP and the Diabetes Coalition and Oregon Action and others to learn, mostly testing our messages, having a quality 101, seeing can they understand that and will that work. In summary, Oregon has a very good foundation to build on. I was describing the Quality Corp. That's only one of many things that are out there. And quality improvement is a key piece of the reform agenda. And by investing in a public-private virtual kind of quality institute, even in these economic lean times, I think we can make a very big difference in Oregon. So thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Chair, I have everybody. Can we do that?
Yeah, I need to reopen the work session. I'm going to reopen a work session on 2197. Is that
94?
2194.
2194.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules to allow Representatives Kotek and Dembro to vote on House Bill 2194.
There's a motion on the floor. Is there any objection to the motion?
Did they bring any candy with them?
Candy was already here. And you can't eat it anyway. So.
And it's not after 4, darn it.
Hearing no objection, we're in reconsideration for the purpose of allowing 2 members to vote. Representative Dembro, how do you vote on 2194?
As amended.
As amended with -1?
I vote aye.
Representative Kotek, how do you vote?
Aye, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the courtesy of allowing us to vote. Appreciate that.
Will you please read the 4 aye votes? And I'll close the work session on 2194.
Close.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
The work session.
We're back open. Are you all through, Nancy?
I would be happy to answer more questions, but if you have none, I thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate you doing.
Before we go on, this may come up, but you know, when you talk about the right amount of care, I think we need to hesitate on saying there is only one standard. And it's about getting the righter care, because so far our variation in care is like this, and the variation in care needs to be more like this, because there is, we don't know everything. But But the problem is the variation of care in Oregon is this wide, and nationwide it's not as, I mean, it's bigger in this room.
Well, I used to read Goldilocks to my kids, so I understand the concept of just right. The point is an important one because, it's a very important one, because the issue is both too little care, I mean, you have all three problems. You have too little care, too much care, and inappropriate care. And we're trying to reduce the variation of all in all three of them. I mean, it's a kind of, so there isn't a magic spot in anything that makes it exactly right.
Well, and I granted I came in near the end of it, but what's really interesting to me is, regardless if your physician provides just that right amount of care, because they're doing everything right, that doesn't mean that the patient or the consumer is going to follow their directions.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, this whole idea of, prescribing two different asthma meds and wanting to know which ones they fill. And, of course, my question is, well, did you call and find out? I had a very interesting experience when I was sick. I went into Kaiser. I went to urgent care. And I actually got a call back, which was odd.
Yeah, I did, too. It was amazing.
It was very odd. The person called me back here in the office on Monday, was asking how I was doing, wanted to make sure that, for some reason, I had to go back in for another x-ray or something. But I was like, wow, they called me back to ask me how I was doing. That was striking to me.
But I would say that
I like to think it's not just because I'm a legislator, but
in the business model, there is absolutely zero incentive to do any of that.
And you're paid on a fee-for-service basis.
Right. Correct.
Yep.
And so...
And that's the difference.
There's a difference, right. And you know, I still... Not that I... There are different ways to do it, but the bottom line is you build your business around how in the heck you get paid for it, and you're not going to do things that cost you money that provide no return. Because ultimately, you want the person to get sick and come back in again.
Actually, my guess is that you usually do it, but it costs you to do it.
You do do it, but
practitioners want to do what's right.
Absolutely, but they are so overburdened, with the 15-minute visit or the 10-minute visit. They know what the right thing to do is. They don't have the time or the resources to do it. It's not that they are not,
But to clarify, you're saying we should pay them for that follow-up phone call.
Or we should pay them in a way that they don't lose money because they do it right.
Correct.
Yeah, and I think a big piece of when we get to quality, it's going to be changing the way healthcare is paid for, particularly primary care.
Absolutely.
Seems to me.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up along those lines, I think we have to remember that there is a substantial segment of the population that is going to need the help of caseworkers or advocates, really, in making these decisions. We can't imagine a general population where everyone is making really smart decisions in front of their computer terminals, because that's really not the way the real world works. And it's not the way that some of the people who are most affected by rising health care costs are.
Yeah, I was counting up, and I was blessed with actually having real interaction with seven different specialists over the last 2 years. And I think I understand the system, and I needed help. This is not just because we have poor old dumb people. It's because this system is really complicated.
My only point of contention in that is that the more complex your situation is, I'm not sure that we could ever get that it's just seamless and simple, because these medical problems are really complex. The specialists are so specialized that it is difficult for them to work across their lines within their fields. And so I'm not quite sure. I think it ends up an amalgamation between fee-for-service for most people and really honest case management, capitation for another segment of population, and maybe something else for another group. I'm not quite sure it's a one-size-fits-all.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. Nancy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have, who's next? Gretchen, you're going to join us alone? Gretchen Morley, please. You're going to come all alone, huh? You're definitely among friends.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. My name is Gretchen Morley. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Policy Commission. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. The reason why I'm here is to give you an update on a project that's underway to align state agency state quality or health quality efforts. So what we're trying to create, you'll see you have a handout in front of you, a one-pager, we're calling a state quality improvement action plan. And so when it says state, we do mean state agencies. There, as you know, there have been a number of reform planning processes over the last few years, and those processes frequently point to where state agencies can be aligning their efforts better. And so we see this as sort of a small piece where we can get started, but a piece of that larger vision of where a quality institute might fit in, which you're going to be hearing more about from Vicki Gates and Carol Robinson next. So this effort began when Oregon was selected for technical assistance from Academy Health and the Commonwealth Fund under a healthcare quality improvement institute they were holding. This institute, while it didn't provide us with additional funding, it's technical assistance focused. Where we see the value is that it gave us that extra push to put the state agency representatives and some others working on quality in the state around a table to really try to get to a concrete action implementation plan. The governor's office asked the Health Policy Commission to give this plan a home, with the idea that the commission would help help with the planning, help with the oversight, give it a public forum where it can be refined publicly. I think the one thing that's worth noting is that I think the commission accepts that there's a certain level of ambiguity in the sort of next 6 months to a year in terms of that you all are having conversations about potentially restructuring health policy at the state level. And I think that we see this as something that the commission can start working on now, take advantage of the technical assistance, move this forward with the idea that maybe in 6 months this is the work that maybe gets handed off to another entity or the commission continues working on it. But it seems like something that needs to be started now. So The technical assistance that we received from Academy Health and the Commonwealth Fund required setting up a state quality improvement team. So that team has now been chartered as a work group of the Health Policy Commission, and that team has representatives from the governor's office, from the various divisions within the Department of Human Services, other state health-focused agencies at the state level, the Office for Oregon Private Health Partnerships and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, PEB, OEB, a number of groups like that, and then we have brought in some representatives from private work that's being done on quality, including Nancy Clark, who you just heard from, and the Hospital Association, and Vicki Gates, who you'll also be hearing from, and then we also have our have legislative representation from both Chair Greenlake and Representative Maurer. So that's the initial group that's helping to put together this plan. And so, like I said, we're trying to focus on where state agencies can coordinate better. And one of the biggest challenges in this kind of work is narrowing that list. And if we're really trying to do an action plan, an implementation plan, even just a first step, it requires a lot of hard work and consensus building and narrowing down the list, because everybody has tons of great ideas about what we can be doing. But it's trying to figure out what are those first things that we can make some progress on. So you'll see in your handout there are six what we kind of critical aspects of what we're trying to, what we're using to sort of hone down this plan. And just really quickly, those include, one, it needs to be something that makes sense to align state agencies on. It's across state agencies that would involve more than one or two agency efforts and think about whether or not it takes advantage of key ways that, three key mechanisms that the state has to improve quality. Then there's also the issue, as I just said, that there's been a lot of planning processes. We want to really take from all that work that's been done, as well as work in other states and nationally, to take that and put it to that next level down of an implementation plan. Not the state should be doing these things, but the plan, but the state across their agencies are furthering this policy area by doing it in these very specific ways, whether that be through contracting, through public health initiatives, through program coordination, that kind of thing. And then we want this to be a first step that's manageable and measurable. So we're looking to get it down to essentially what you could, you know, keep saying sort of the elevator speech on what it is, being able to allow people to get their minds around what it is that we're working on, not have a sort of whole long list of ideas, and then also be able to measure some very, identify some very concrete both process and outcome metrics to be followed over time. So where we are now is that the group's been meeting for a number of months. We have been able to narrow down the policy areas to ones that include patient safety, preventive slash primary care, consumer engagement, and data collection and transparency. And so where the team is now is that over the next couple of months, they will be taking those areas and the very specific examples of how the state can push quality and wrangling through which ones make the most sense to be a part of a short-term plan versus ones that you would want to continue to develop for later stages of the plan. So our goal in the short term is to have a draft plan together for a Academy Health Commonwealth Fund conference that's going on in May, with the idea that we're assuming that we would need to regroup post-legislative session in terms of any policy changes that occurred during the session. So that's the end of my prepared remarks. I'm willing to take any questions.
I guess I'd just like to comment. It seems obvious that the state agencies should all be aligned on something as important as this, but anybody that's been involved with state government understands it's not obvious at all. There's nothing obvious about it with the silos we have. And I think the collaboration that's been shown in this from across several groups is really quite extraordinary. You've done a great job herding those cats. Hmm. Any questions? Comments?
No. Vim Vival, the president, new president of
Portland State.
Herding cats, all you do is you need to rattle the food dish.
Have a lot of catnip with
catnip.
Yeah. I'm not sure what that would be in a state meeting. But
candy.
Yeah, that's what she uses to keep us under control.
But it has to be healthy. It would need to be apples or grapes or something.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Oh, no.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Actually, okay? I do think chocolate is essential when we're talking healthcare reform.
Dark chocolate.
So, ever being the practical person that I am, you know, as we look at things in the budget committees, particularly around the Division of Medical Assistance Programs and how we work with our managed care plans, I mean, we have an opportunity to start perhaps, pushing down the quality pathway with what we can control the state, which is the plans that we negotiate with to provide services through the Oregon Health Plan. You don't have to answer the question now, but if you were me and you were sitting in a budget committee and were wondering what we should do differently in the next biennium to help push our contractors in that direction, I'm always open to ideas. So, and Representative Greenlink is on that subcommittee as well. I just would hate to miss an opportunity for this two-year budget cycle that we could start incentivizing doing things differently. I know you're coming up with a larger report, but if you've got some ideas you want to share later, we'd be open to them. So.
In fact, if you have any ideas you want to share off the record, we wouldn't tell where they came from.
Absolutely. Well, I think the one piece I know that one of the recent meetings that Chair Greenlink was involved in, we did talk about as sort of laying out this plan, is really making it clear what are the things that state agencies could be doing with current structure, current resources, and sort of piecing out the pieces that that maybe you can do it this much with current resources, but if you had some additional resources in very targeted areas or some restructuring, it could go this far. That was also more applied to the discussion of whether or not there would be any funding from, say, Commonwealth Fund or other funders in the future to help some of these initiatives as well. So it wasn't just sort of a discussion about state resources, but resources overall. So we are thinking that way.
Well, but to follow up on that, if I may, we potentially might have some dollars to play with if we're successful in passing a provider tax. And if we, for example, wanted to change our reimbursement rates in such a way to incentivize different types of care, I'm just saying I'm open. And we might have money to play with, because I'm always the optimist in terms of how we set reimbursement rates for what we want to pay for, getting back to your original comment about what are we paying for. So
you might call it pay for performance or something weird like that.
Maybe. I don't know.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Greg.
We have Carol Robinson and Vicki Gates. Join us, please. I want to step out of order here because we have some new people on this committee who haven't necessarily been around the healthcare field very long, and we have in Ms. Gates, one of our true health heroes in this community. So I wonder if you could suspend your usual southern modesty and tell us things you've been involved in this state on the way to here. Vicki.
Representative Greenleck and members of the committee, I'll suspend my southern modesty and my concern about revealing just how old
introduce
I actually
yourself first,
am.
Please.
I'm Vicki Gates. I'm retired, other than volunteer things that I do. And I've been in Oregon. I was in Oregon for a long time. So basically, I guess what Mitch wants me to tell you is that during that period of time, I was the first of your Oregon health plan administrators and started the Office of Health Policy and Research. And in fact, Representative Greenleck and I worked on the first quality report card for Medicare plans. He was very helpful in obtaining federal funding and helping us put that project together, and it was one of the things that when the health reform legislation was specifically requested. I've been involved in trying to bring the purchasers of Oregon together to see what they can do as a force for quality. I've served as the first executive director for the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation. I've spent time in the District of Columbia working for Academy Health and working, running a Robert Wood Johnson program called the State Coverage Initiatives Program, which is designed to help states who want to expand health care coverage. And in that context, was able to keep track of what was going on in Oregon as we went through a severe downturn and some real need to readjust the plan, and have been back and working on interesting projects and going to a lot of meetings, some of which I'm going to talk about. Is that adequate?
That's great. Vicki was always very successful dealing with the legislature in her term here because I believed it was because she could say whatever outrageous thing she said to a legislator, she said it in that nice, soft southern accent. Nobody noticed how outrageous it was.
You know, I believe that it was because I spent a decade balancing and rebalancing a very volatile Department of Human Resources, which now is called DHS. And, you know, if you can bring solutions in that kind of environment, you basically are going to get along with people.
Ms. Robinson, I didn't want to slight you as one of the rising stars in the field. Help making sure folks got to know Vicki a little better. You guys are on.
Well, what I'm going to do is talk about a quality piece that was part of the Oregon Health Fund Board. And this is, of course, the scheme that the Oregon Health Fund Board has used to talk about what the building blocks for reform are. And if you think about the role that quality plays, it's setting high standards. It's stimulating system innovation and improvement. It's actually part of equity. It's really interesting that as Robert Wood Johnson defines quality, they used to have a quality stream, an equity stream, and like the Institute of Medicine, healthcare that's not equitable is really not quality care. So basically, I think there's a piece of that, and certainly there are real implications for the healthcare workforce as we look at health quality agendas. Now, it was Senate Bill 329, which you yourselves developed, that directed the development of a Model Quality Institute for Oregon, and the decision was made to integrate this into the Health Fund Board's work. Of the six committees, Delivery Systems was the committee that, in fact, chartered the Quality Institute Work Group, and it's the group that we reported back to and from there went to the fund board.
Was 329 from last session?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From the 07 session. Okay. It passed the House and the Senate basically unanimous. I think the House vote was 55-2 or something like that.
You know, This is the work group membership, and what you'll see is both the organizations that are represented, which is fairly broad, but the people who were on this really were not just chosen because they represented an organization. They really also represented people who had a passion for quality. For example, Glenn Rodriguez, who heads quality for the hospital systems in Providence, served as the first chair for the Oregon Quality Corporation, served as the first chair for the Patient Safety Commission. Glenn Munoz, who runs Virginia Garcia, is involved in Care Oregon's project to look at how to develop a medical home, how to integrate electronic health records into a healthcare environment, and is currently also working on how do you really effectively integrate mental health services, behavioral health services, into the healthcare system. So we looked for people who had a role in their organization for quality, who would bring some passion and some expertise to the committee. And that actually was what made the committee somewhat fun. We also started our work with sort of some classic work, and if you get the full report of the committee, one of the things you'll see is the list of groups in Oregon that are working on quality. We put together a matrix of that, and it'll run about 8 pages, I think. We also tried to look at other states. Who's setting a benchmark? We looked, for example, at the 3Ms, Maine, Massachusetts. We drafted our problem statement, we tried to get our definitions clear, and we clarified our starting assumptions, and then we began to think about, if you had this creature, what would it do? What difference could it make? What would be the value added of trying to have a more collaborative and coordinated effort around quality in the state of Oregon? And then we were charged with developing recommendations for governance, funding, and the structure. What we assumed, because we had looked at the amount of quality work going on in Oregon, is that what the Quality Institute should do is coordinate and strengthen what was really going on. That it should help fill in gaps, it should help bring people together, it should in fact be a force for synergy. It would need to be integrated into a sustainable health reform plan. It had the opportunity to capitalize on a great deal of activity, such as the activity Nancy and the Quality Corp were engaged in. And unfortunately, we believed as a group that it would need resources to support its efforts and to create an agenda, an effective quality agenda. So when we looked at roles, which we really thought was one of our major roles, we separated them into coordination and collaboration, the systematic measurement of quality, provider improvement and technical assistance, how is it that you engage consumers, and we haven't really come very far in almost 2 decades of work in getting consumers more sophisticated about what quality is and how to use it. And we also felt that it would be an expert resource for policymakers if it brought together the right talent and the right resources.
May I interrupt?
Mm-hmm.
You said the lack of sophistication. Is quality value to the patient or value to the system? Because I think they're different. Quite frankly, the patient interaction or primary care is how good do I feel when I walk out the door? Do I have a script in hand? You know, if I didn't
have
get a script.
Have they met my expectations?
Yes. And that's not always the same.
Representative Maurer, I'm going to take Representative Greenlick's charge to go ahead and forget a little bit of the protocol. In fact, they may be satisfied, but they might be more satisfied if they had walked in, say, if they had a chronic condition, understanding how they might have a better interaction with their physician, what the expectations might be for quality of care, what their role might be in maintaining their health. So there's a lot of room for the patient to take value out by understanding more about their condition, their expectations, and how to deal with the healthcare system. Now, there's another set of issues about value to the system. And, of course, one of the things that's really interesting in Representative Kotek, you may be interested in this, there's an organization that's actually developing an ROI set of research on quality. And they're developing this primarily for Medicaid. It's the Center for Health System Strategies. But what they're doing is going in and looking and saying, where do you get a major payoff for your quality activities? And talking about how do you stratify patients, how do you target?
Yeah, I guess I'd like to comment on that as well. And part of that patient expectation comes out of the fact that the physicians are so loaded that they don't necessarily have time to do the right thing. It is much harder for a physician when a patient comes in and says, I have a cold, I need an antibiotic, to write a prescription for the antibiotic than it is to say, look, this is not in your best interest. Let's talk about what's going on here. I think unless X and Y and Z happens, you should not have an antibiotic because it opens you up for secondary infection. That's going to be a problem. Here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like to talk to you again tomorrow, see how things are going. If your temperature goes up this way, then we'll do this. I mean, it's a much more complicated interaction. And when they're in 15-minute appointments, I told Harriet the other way, she's been scheduling my morning 4 appointments every 15 minutes each hour, and it says it made me feel like a primary care doc. But it really, I mean, it really, I don't think we really can have an insight into what that 3 20-minute appointments every hour for 8 hours a day is like.
You know, one of the things that's interesting as Care Oregon, for example, is working on the concept of medical home and actually implementing that in a number of clinics. They're moving away from the 15-minute appointment. They're moving to a team strategy. They're providing physicians with a level of support. They're trying to ally them with behavioral health providers. They're using skills and tools and auxiliary services that make it possible for them to use their skills in a different way and practice medicine in a different way. And one of the things that you will consistently hear from people who are engaged in that process is they are more satisfied.
They being?
The physician. The physician is more satisfied. Team members who now are doing things that are more exciting for them to be doing than some of the clerical things that they were doing before, and clerical people who have more exciting jobs because they're, in fact, talking to patients. And we are beginning, at least some of the organizations, are beginning to see some improved outcomes.
It'd be interesting to see how much that costs, too.
Well, you know, that's another set of issues, and one of the things is, can you do that for everybody? Can you target it? Can you integrate it? Can you have an infrastructure that's strong enough that, in fact, it doesn't become that expensive? And one of the things that, at least a practice in Utah found, is that when you separate out and put these things out with teams, and you have different lower-paid people who are part of the process, that you can improve the productivity of your physician staff, you can do more, you can see more people, and you can do it for the same amount of money. So we're in a learning mode, and it's really interesting to me that as we look at the stimulus package, we're going to have billions that are going to be invested in electronic health records. We're going to have big money that's invested in interoperability, and $1.9 billion, which to me is just amazing, in comparative effectiveness research.
See about that.
But it does mean that there'll be a series of resources and opportunities for rethinking how some of the care is delivered. We might as well be optimistic about feeling that we can provide care in a better, more cost-effective way that's actually more satisfying for the people who are engaged as well as the patient.
Okay.
But at any rate, here's what we thought were the roles. That there should be goals and standards, that we needed to set and prioritize some ambition for Oregon in the quality area, that one of the things that this Institute could do is convene public and private stakeholders, take all of this talent and organizations that are out there working and make it make more sense, common quality metrics, learning collaboratives, technical assistance, streamlining information reporting, bringing information together in a different way. As exciting as what a project like Nancy's is doing, there still will be a point when we look at the system that we need to think in terms of episodes of care, that we need to think about the interaction between the physician and the hospital. We need to look at those patterns if we're really going to look at how some things are occurring in healthcare that might have potential to do it more effectively and more efficiently. And very importantly, improve the database, improve what's available to people. But, of course, the thing about databases is you also have to improve people's ability to use them. They have to be actionable. They have to have the expertise and the ability to make use of them. We currently have lots of data that people don't use, as much as we all love it. Now, benefits, which you would hope. The first player on the list is employers. And, of course, employers have been very active in this arena. They've really wanted to get more value out of the health investment that they're making. But, you know, one of the things I want to bring to your attention is consumers are paying more and more of the cost of health care. We are deliberately, as a cost strategy, moving costs to consumers. A third of adults spend 10% of their income on their premiums and their out-of-pocket health care. For plans that are delivered to organizations that are under 200, premiums have quadrupled in less than a decade. Deductibles have quadrupled, I mean. You've seen more and more out-of-pocket. And so it's not just the employer who's got a value agenda with health care. I think there's a value agenda for the consumer, too, because they've got a real stake in this game.
Why does the employer have a stake?
Because the employer is paying a tremendous amount of money.
No, that's not my point. I know that.
Right.
Why is the employer injected in this conversation? Why was it injected in the first place? And should the... Because, to me, the consumer should be at the top. I mean, they're the patient. They're the ones, the employer, for them, it's a business transaction. And
Representative Maurer, I have to tell you that basically I agree. Because, in fact, there's the issue that I just talked about, which is very obvious to all of us. If you take a look at health care costs versus wages, it's very clear what people have been trading off in many cases in lower wage jobs. And, in fact, if you look at where your hot union issues have been, they certainly more often have been around health care benefits than they've been around wages. Mm-hmm. So, in effect, it's part of the compensation package. And I believe most people know how important it is and that it represents a major part of their reimbursement. And then, of course, lastly, it's their life, their body, their sense of well-being, et cetera. We really, you know, one of the things that IOM, the Institute of Medicine, says about quality is that it's patient-centered. It's around human beings.
But Vicki, I think it's very interesting to have the employers here because you generally tend to hear employers talking about the cost of health care. And what this statement does is it converts that to a question of value. And I think that the suspicion of many employers is both that they're paying too much, I think
right.
That's the first thing, but that they're also not getting enough for what they're paying in terms of value. And I mean, I think that putting quality into the value equation seems pretty important.
It's been a major part of the employer agenda for a long time, particularly large employers. And there are some that are benchmark employers. They've actually spent a lot of time and effort trying to think about what a value-based benefit package might look like. the group that I think is really frustrated, and I say this having read and listened to small employer focus groups all over the United States, they are incredibly frustrated by being forced into a price issue. Everything else they buy, they have in fact seen benefit from automation, come down in price, be competitive, and they're typically locked into local healthcare markets where they feel like they have no choice other than to get out of the healthcare business or to rearrange business priorities. There's incredible frustration among small employers. So they do play a tremendous role. And, of course, you know, we have two other key players, providers, and their ability. And I think Nancy did a great job of explaining how much stuff goes into the round file because it's really not organized for people who are busy and who can make use of it and have it be actionable information. And lastly, the legislature deals with quality, cost, value issues in healthcare every session. You spend major amounts of money. It's a major economic issue for Oregon. And one of the roles that the committee felt really made some sense is for there to be a resource on a quality agenda that would be available to policymakers and to organizations like employers, et cetera, other players in the field. We were asked to make recommendations about the governance and the structure, and one of the decisions that was very quickly made is that it should be a collaborative type of structure. It should be a public-private partnership, publicly chartered. And we had a rather eloquent discussion from Glenn Rodriguez on the difference between the Q Corp, which is doesn't have the benefits since the legislature at one point in time neglected to pass some legislation that would have chartered a quality corporation, and the Patient Safety Commission, which was able to start with the benefits of a legislative background. Strong confidentiality protections for the data, and a board of directors that's knowledgeable about and committed to quality improvement. A lot of concern because there are many organizations out there like the Q Corp who basically have fought their way through to resources to be able to do this work, have done difficult negotiations. So can we have a lean organization that hopefully would tie up and connect with other organizations in regard to administration? We did think this was worth investing money in, that it would be a magnet for other funding, and that it had the opportunity to do what foundations have done in terms of reaching out and really having leverage to partner with other organizations. It's like the candy to keep the meeting going and the other things that happen. It's easier to be a partner when you bring something to the table, and you can provide some ability to push collaboration in a different way. And we really do believe that because it's a collaborative strategy, that it has the ability to maximize output and eliminate duplication of effort. We had a consultant who told us we ought to have a logic model. And, you know, actually it is good to think about, is your logic strong? Does it make sense? Will it, in fact, if you have certain strategies, do you have some hope of getting the change that you'd like? And so this is ours, but we developed in an assortment of colors. And much of this has, in fact, been incorporated.
Would you go back, please?
Would you just read what the purple things are there?
Okay, let me go back and find the purple
there.
Things.
That's the outcomes, right?
They're the outcomes, the change that you would expect. Availability of comparable and systematic data about quality and utilization of resources. Creation of a policy environment that promotes continuous quality improvement. Improve quality of clinical care and reduce variation among providers. Increase use of data for healthcare decision-making by all of the players that are part of the system.
Well, that sure be nice, huh?
Yes, Representative Greenlick, it would be very nice. Oh, messed up. Little TA here. This is, in fact, what the report the Health Fund Board has included in its discussion of the Quality Institute. It is part of the thinking. The roles, I think, are very much like the things that I've discussed and that the committee put forth as adding value to the system. So that's how you got to that piece of your 2009.
Great. Vicki, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Did we get any?
No,
we'll
do
lots
of questions.
Why don't you have a few?
Well, I
Terrell, if you'd like to comment before
you know, I'm not suggesting at all that the employer doesn't have a vested interest in a healthy workforce. That's totally not the point. The point is, it seems to me that the employer's involvement in the purchase of health insurance is an extraneous piece of the equation. That you know, the employer can reimburse me for purchasing and say, as a condition of employment, you will have insurance because I'm paying you to do it. But I want this to be me. I want this to be my policy. And it could go through a portal, an exchange, or something. But I want it to be mine. I want it to follow me from wherever I go, because it's not about IBM or the state of Oregon. It's about me and my family. And so that's why I just question that piece of it.
Representative Maurer, I understand better now the point that you were making. We could have a different system. There is no doubt. The role of the employer happened because of historical issues, tax codes, and a set of other things. Employers now, many of them really look at it as a recruitment tool and something that's important to them and that they've made an investment in. If we were to move to a different system, and in some cases I think their employers would be very happy to see that as an option, then we will need to do something about the way people can access health care. We will need an exchange. We will need a different way of marketing health care. We will need a different way of interacting with consumers, because the current individual market is not going to adequately serve that set of needs. And you will have to figure out, do you use an exchange? Do you use something that is different to, in fact, do it? And, of course, Representative Wyden has proposed in his bill some rather radical changes. They've happened before. In terms of people saying, yes, we could do this all in a different way, which we could. But we would want to keep employer dollars in the system. It's a radical change. There are many employees who are really, they like the current arrangement. So it could go either way, but it would take some real thinking through.
You know, if I may. You know, you are an employee of the federal government. The federal government doesn't tell you. They just say, here's a piece of paper, go figure it out. Honestly, that's what they do. And you go to the Federal Employee Health Benefit Portal, and you, in Oregon, you've got 40 different options to choose from. But they don't, I mean, they don't essentially hold your hand. In the state of Oregon, as a state employee, my hand is held. I have one option. I have no options where I live in Southern Oregon. It's Regents. That's it. No options. That's it. That's what you get. And all I, you know, it's just, right. It is not the employer's decision to tell me what I need to do. Now, granted, the money is really nice, and the tax benefit, that's why you do it through the employer. But if I leave the state of Oregon's employment, I'd like to be able, other than COBRA, you know, into a system that's larger, that this belongs to me. Now the insurance company has a vested interest in managing me as a patient or as a consumer for more than a 12-month period. They have a vested interest over a period of time in ensuring that I'm healthy, because
And we will, in fact, Representative Maurer, need to rethink the way the insurance system operates and the way people deal with risk to be able to do that. Because, of course, what one of the things about the way employers structure the market is, in fact, they structure it by employer and not by whether or not people make decisions on risk. So if you're part of a big employment group and you're part of it, the coverage, you typically will take it unless your employer has a fairly limited policy, fairly high copays, and then in which case he may have to get a certain percentage of participation to guarantee that those folks who are healthy decide that they'll take the extra bucks and run, and the people who are sick won't. So what we have not been successful in pooling, and one of the reasons that a lot of pooling ideas have not worked well, is because they have not dealt well with a risk set of issues, so that, in fact, you are grouping and you are doing more and more community rating and risk, which is one of the things. When people talk about really rearranging the system, they talk about doing that at the same time, creating new ways of having people access
their policy. It is interesting that the basic notion is that who pays the piper gets to call the tune. But the concept that I think more and more people recognize is that it's not really the employer that's paying in that case. It's a part of a compensation package that's being delivered in a particular way. And I think that's your point, that mm-hmm. that you're the one that's paying, the individual is the one that's paying, and ought to be able to call the tune, even though it's being filtered through an employer.
Right, absolutely. You know, it's very interesting today. Statesman Journal, SEIU says that they'll accept 8 days of furlough and a couple other things. They didn't talk about benefits, which tells me that their value is benefits, because that is such a huge piece of that compensation package. And I've been really pretty vocal about that whole issue. Maybe not that vocal, but, you know, get hammered for saying that. But it is very interesting. And, you know, but the employees don't have any place else to go. It is really based on their employment. And I was told, it was told back in school a long time ago by a sociology professor, and she said, "Don't sell your soul for dental insurance." Well, we do that today. We sell our soul to keep our health insurance.
No, that's unfortunately right.
Sell your soul to the government
store.
What? You're selling your soul to the government store.
That's
what you're doing, yeah.
Thank you.
I know you can't resist getting into.
No,
I just got on this level.
I really can't actually. And Representative Maurer is making just a lot of sense in my view. I think he's right on. Actually, my point is somewhat different, and it's just simply to point out what may be obvious, but it's that it seems so clear to me that in this issue, when we're talking about healthcare, the quality horse is pulling in the same direction as the cost containment horse. And I'm not suggesting we should talk about quality in terms of cost containment, but it's really one of the things that helps me stay hopeful about this subject, and one of the things that's exciting about the work we're doing, is that they're kind of pulling along the same way. If we did these things, we would probably ultimately be looking at a system that was not only producing better outcomes and greater patient satisfaction, but was also costing less money. I'm not sure you can always say that about, you know, when we talk about education, I'm not sure it's, you can line things up the same direction, but here we can, and that's very exciting. Your work, I think, helps confirm that, and let's keep at it.
Just wanted to go back and clarify or check out one of your comments hit me pretty hard. Did I get that right, that a third of adults spend 10% of their incomes on health care?
Yes.
That was the right number. A third of adults throughout the entire state. This is a state figure?
This is national. This is national, a national figure. It's based on a piece of research that Commonwealth Fund does on a regular basis.
Do you know more
basis.
About the demographic on that?
That's under 65, I think.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm trying to understand.
I think the over 65 pay more than 10%.
Right. Well, that's right, and I'm just trying to understand what that demographic really is, because that's a rather remarkable number.
Well, and, you know, that's one of the reasons I wanted to make the point about the economic stake that the consumer has in the system and the growing amount of money that the consumer is, in fact, investing, and their concern for value. Even if it's not always articulated, it's a really important issue.
If the cost goes up and they pay more and more, they are concerned about the value of this. When the employer did it and it was free and an employer was happy because it wasn't that expensive and they used it as a benefit to attract people, the consumer really was arm's length. And I tell you, when you write the check, all of a sudden the conversation really changes.
It does change, but one of the things that you have to keep in mind, and there's some research, Representative Maurer, that sometimes when people are really underinsured, they will make decisions that financially make sense and from a health perspective don't. And there has been some significant research on people who won't take their medication appropriately, won't do certain things that actually do make a difference. So there's always a line about where's the right point.
We see it in our clinic, people on their deathbed making decisions about money. You know, you say, if I'm happy, or I've got everything if I have my health. Well, no, they're on their deathbed, and they're worried about what's going to happen to their children, and, oh, I don't want to leave any debt to my children, and they make those decisions, and it's fascinating why people would think, especially when it's theirs. Mm-hmm. Now, if it's someone else's money, it's like, give me everything. And it's stunning.
Robinson, you want to take a shot at this?
Thank you, Chair.
Do the final word.
Final word. Thank you very much, Chair Greenlick, committee members. I'm Carol Robinson, for the record, Interim Director of Oregon Health Fund Board. And I'd like to start first by taking a kind of a wide-angle lens view of this, and then I'd like to finish by getting more specific and addressing some of the questions that have been brought up as well. I am honored to follow Vicki Gates and her esteemed accomplishments and work, and I know that you've appreciated her testimony as well as Nancy's and Gretchen's. And I... we'll start right now with my testimony with a quote. And this is a book that I love, this book, and open it frequently. And it's called Better, A Surgeon's Notes on Performance. And it's written by a doctor at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston named Atul Gawande. And you'll also read his essays frequently in The New Yorker. I recommend anything he writes. So the quote begins with this: "People underestimate the importance of diligence as a virtue. No doubt this has something to do with how supremely mundane it seems. It is defined as the constant and earnest effort to accomplish what is undertaken. There is a flavor of simplistic relentlessness to it, and if it were an individual's primary goal in life, that life would indeed seem narrow and unambitious. Understood, however, as the prerequisite of great accomplishments, diligence stands as one of the most difficult challenges facing any group of people who take on tasks of risk and consequence. It sets a high, seemingly impossible expectation for performance and human behavior. Yet some, in medicine, have delivered on that expectation on an almost unimaginable scale." And then Dr. Gawande, in his book, goes on to provide compelling accounts about how individual physicians, hospital systems, governments, and even the World Health Organization have organized with diligence and an unrelenting drive for improving performance in healthcare to make a difference in the quality of health and the quality of care. And some examples that he uses in this book gives the readers a look at the improvements of medical care on the battlefield, a hand-washing campaign at his own hospital, and a campaign to eradicate polio in India. So you can see the narrow or very broad focus of how quality measures and steps can be taken, big and small. The takeaway from reading this book for me was how simple some steps to improving quality can be. Simply like increasing hand washing in hospitals or a surgical checklist. And how incredibly difficult it can be to break down barriers to change, whether in a hospital, a government, or even within ourselves. So the formation of a quality institute, as you have heard, would organize the tremendous efforts, public and private, of those who are delivering better performance, measuring performance, and setting standards for improving performance in a way that would replicate and elevate the diligence of some to a scale where the entire state of Oregon could be an example for Dr. Gawande's next book on improving quality in a health system. So borrowing an analogy from my esteemed predecessor, Barney Speight, the Oregon Health Fund Board likens the formation of a quality institute to the formation of a symphony orchestra. Each individual clarinet or viola or cello playing a different song at the same time is cacophonous. But add a conductor and put the same sheet of notes in front of the musicians and you'll hear beautiful music from the same instruments. So the takeaway on that is that the organization of many efforts brings far greater results. And for that reason, the Oregon Health Fund Board believes that the formation of a quality institute as part of a health authority in House Bill 2009 is an idea that would yield tremendous results for Oregon. And now I'm going to narrow down on some specifics in relationship to the conversation that you've had, Nat, just in this room, and summing up the investment that needs to be made. So some of the questions or comments that you heard earlier were about the coordination of public and private partners. And I'd like to emphasize that the great work that the Quality Corporation is doing is funded largely by grants and foundation money. And so as well as the work that the Health Policy Commission is doing that you've heard about. And they're building steps with private money, and those are important, and they're valuable, and they should continue. But that is not the kind of organization that we need to sustain that kind of symphony that of diligence that can be put together. So the funding issue is important. I'm also going to talk a little bit about the building blocks that you saw in the Health Fund Board's plan, because so much, actually everything that you'll see before this committee from the Health Fund Board builds on each other. So we talked about the data and the need for quality data that's secure and consistent, it's consistent reporting. So you've heard maybe a little bit about an all funds, all payer database as part of the health funds proposal. Other pieces link together, and the other day I was listening to testimony in this committee hearing, and I heard Representative Maurer talk about the coverage piece, and if we do this, are we going to forget to think about cost containment, and how do we start bending that cost curve? And so I would argue that the two are completely tied together and have to be. And so you've heard me maybe testify before this committee before saying there's dual tracks of health reform, and with one rail, the train can't move down the track. We have to have the expansion so that people have the coverage, and at the same time, improve healthcare for all through quality measures, through consistency, And the delivery system changes that begin to lower the costs so that the every penny that we put into healthcare through expansion can be sustained. Why not cost and quality at the same time? And there's an example of that that I've used before, so forgive me for those who've heard it. There's a system in Seattle, Virginia Mason, that took a leap of faith in a way and said, why not apply the principles of lean to healthcare? And they went over to, they sent over a 1,000 of their employees, I believe, over to Japan to study the Toyota production system and their total quality system of production. And then they came back and they tried to implement that and institute it at their hospital system. And it's really become actually a business driver for them. They now have a business talking about their quality measures. What they found is that it lowers their costs too. Because one example of that is just putting those evidence-based guidelines, another component of the Health Fund Board's plan that you'll see, in place to guide medical decisions, consistent results. So the back surgeries that you may have heard me discuss before, people with back pain arriving, their previous methodology of care was an MRI, rest, anti-inflammatories. A percentage of those needed surgery. They decided to change the order of that and start with anti-inflammatories and rest, lowering the number of the MRIs that they needed to deliver, and a pretty consistent number of people needed surgery. So we've lowered the cost of healthcare by implementing simple steps and standards. And that's what I believe that a quality institute through public and private work together would be able to do. I'm going to read you one more thing and then I'll stop. You'll be glad, I'm sure. the vision of the Health Fund Board is much larger than what we in Oregon are currently doing to improve quality. For example, payer data could be used for much more in the policy arena than we have permission or resources to explore. Support to clinicians, consumers, and purchasers to actually use the data we produce is quite limited compared to the vision in the Health Fund report. And that was written by the Quality Corporation. So the work that all of the private partners are doing, the work that the Health Policy Commission is starting to do, needs this oversight organizer to be as effective as possible. And I thank you so much today for the chance to testify.
Carol, thank you. Are there any questions? I don't think so.
No, I think the approach that is happening this from last session with 329 and going forward makes a whole lot more sense in addressing the conversation than 2 years ago, the cigarette tax, which was cover kids. Okay, without the ability to address the quality and all these other issues, because it wasn't at that point. There would have been a lot of the conversation, but that conversation was strictly about coverage, with nothing else around it, and I think the conversation is a lot different today.
Chair Greenlee, Representative Mallett, that's the beauty of my job, is because I get to come and talk to you about a report that I believe in 100%. And the reason why I believe in it is because they put that cost control, bending the cost curve up front, and they knew how important that was to sustain the coverage that we need to have an organ. So it's a hand-in-hand approach. Thanks.
Carol, I think your point that Virginia Mason took a leap of faith is also an important one, because we're not completely empirically set on these things. Let's get on a path and try and find a way to do it in it. It will take a leap of faith, but I suppose doing nothing takes a leap of faith as well. Mm-hmm. And there are
I was intrigued with that Brigham and Women's example about hand washing, which came out of a Massachusetts General study earlier on. And the reason that's important is because in order to achieve what they wanted to achieve, it took upfront resources. Because what they found, the variable wasn't how often you hammered the physician or anything else, it was whether you put a sink outside of every room. And if you made that investment to put a sink outside of everything outside of every single room, everything else followed because it allowed the physicians to do what they knew they should do anyway. It facilitated their ability to do it. And that was a one-time investment, but it was a required investment. And we need to be thinking about what it is we need to invest in order to get this train moving.
Come to Three Rivers Hospital. Every room is built with a sink inside every patient room, right at the door. And they're losing $15 million this year.
Certainly wasn't because of the sinks. Thank you very much for coming. It was a very informative afternoon. We hear about these quality things. It's very important for us to have some understanding of where we're going as we begin to think about how we move forward. And for the record, it's 4:44
on a Friday afternoon,
and we're adjourned.